Okay, welcome to episode 36 of the Never Iron Anything podcast, the occasional comics discussion with a pal about a character, a series, or a creator. Today we have a returning guest. My name's Tony Esmond, by the way. We have a returning guest, and he is what I'm going to describe as the emperor of the black and white comic. Comics fan, comics creator, runner of a kick-ass Kickstarter at the moment. It's Mr. Alan Henderson. Hello, Alan.
Greetings.
Going well, man. Kicking ass some Kickstarters.
There's I keep saying there's lots of good books up in Kickstarter.
It's a place to be now, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a penned Gwen book, which is coincidence.
Don't be like that. Come on. Yeah, I'm pleased, man. Really good. I did the old. We were just talking about before we came on about the. There's like a pre-order, and there's like a notification email you can sign up for now, which seems to be the thing people do more and more now, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know you went with it. I know Chris Simba, who's got one going at the moment as well, did it. And I always try and sign up for them because I'm a bit OCD, so I always like to be in the single figures of the person who, you know, pledges.
Yeah. Well, I think it also worked well because when Russell did his, I signed up for it.
Yeah.
And if you hadn't basically signed up, you almost had no chance of getting in early for some of his originals.
Yeah, so, that's the way to go now, isn't it? Yeah, really.
It's certainly worth it for that perspective.
Yeah, no, I'm chuffed, man. It's going well, and deservedly so. And you promised to send me some more toilet paper, which is very kind of you.
I shall endeavour to do so.
Right, so in a slight change of pace from Penguins, you're going to tell us what the book is we're going to be talking about today.
So the book specifically we're going to talk about is Queen and Country, Operation Broken Ground, which represents the first four issues of the Queen and Country series that was produced or written by Greg Rucka with a multitude of artists throughout. And in this particular case, it's Steve Rollison.
It is. And he's probably, there's no one who does loads of Queen and Country, but he does quite a bit, doesn't he?
He certainly comes back for another couple of arcs.
Yeah, one issue on its own, doesn't he, or something, I think, as well. Is that right? Is it like a single part of an issue he comes back for?
Yeah. I think one of the reasons, to make clear, why is there multiple artists on this? In terms of how the story is presented across the whole of this series, it is treated as being the operations that the agents go on in terms of this and saying, this is basically the folder of that particular operation, always packaged up that way. And obviously each time they move to a new folder or a new operation, they basically say, here's a new artist, which
I kind of dug that. I like the sort of the operational folder and some of the interior design work is done as if it's the old school brown folder, isn't it, you know, with the sort of the name on the side of it. He Rucka, to be fair, writes all of them apart from one, I think, doesn't he? He writes, doesn't Anthony, this is slightly, so it's Queen and Country Declassified is three trades, which come out, do they come out afterwards or do they come out?
No, it came out, so Queen and Country, in total there's 32 issues that ran 2001 through 2007.
Yeah.
But there were three mini-series that were dotted in and around it.
Oh, I
wondered about
that.
They were all called Declassified. Now, all of the Declassified storylines are actually prequels.
Right,
to the Queen and Country
story. One's based in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Which is a very good one.
Yeah. And features the as one of the operatives who's in the main storyline was a junior officer in let's say the SAS. While in the Northern Ireland story, and basically, so he then becomes a more senior character in the main body of the book.
Right.
So
okay.
So Declassified are those prequels, alongside the actual comics. Greg Rucka, reflecting back to his base, if you like, has also produced three prose novels on that.
Yes,
for the
and I've only
piece.
Read one of them, and I have to say, well, we should probably get this out. Have you read them, Al, have you?
I have. I've got all three, yeah.
Good man. Well, the one that I read is the one that I had to put down because it just, I went, there's a bomb on a tube, and I think I read it around the same time as there was a bomb on the tube.
Because it came out about 3 months before 7/7.
That's right. I've heard him talk about this. Yeah, it's really prophetic, isn't it?
It was one of these ones where he was like going, look, I wrote that 18 months prior, you know, in terms of the timeline we normally take, you know, and it is, you know, much in the same way there are stories written about bombings at the Twin Towers, etc. Just happen chance in terms of, well, look, you're going to, if you're going to write this sort of story, sometimes you'll reflect what ends up happening in real life, but it's not, you know. So yeah, so I think that's Gentleman's Game, the one that you're referring to.
Yeah, I've got it. I can't quite see it from here, but I've got them. I've bought all three, but I've only so far read one of them, to be fair. But I like his writing. I like his prose.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to ask
as well,
you,
he did, sorry, man, did a really nice thing with those prose novels, because he knew he was tapping in perhaps to the comics audience in a big way.
Right.
At the time, what he did was, if you could send him a copy of your pre-order receipt, he would send you a signed tipping plate to put into the novels.
Nice. Okay.
So the very first one of those is actually a Steve Rolson one that's the signed for Gentleman's Game.
Oh, good.
That was a nice way of doing that.
Now, am I right in saying that Queen and Country Declassified, I've got them actually, just out of sight from where I'm sitting again, but wasn't one of them written by Anthony Johnson? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So Anthony Johnson wrote one of them under direction by Greg Rucka.
Right.
They worked, so I presume Rucka basically acted as one of the editors on it to help clarify. The other connection that then goes on with Anthony Johnson is, if you read The Coldest City, ignore the movie.
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
And read Coldest City. Rucka has basically said that he's more, you know, that in the, and I think it's, I mentioned it to Auntie Johnson as well, but at Con once. Essentially, that could be in the Queen and Country universe as well. Because again, it's just a different set of spies. So it's slightly earlier because it's more sort of a Cold War, isn't
it? Yeah,
in Berlin. So it's essentially the same, but more that, you know. So Anthony Johnson clearly has that sort of connection into the side of things.
Interesting.
As well.
Yeah, they're very similar. Well, they're not very similar characters. There's a difference, but you can definitely see them meshing together. And for those who are wondering what movie we mentioned there, that was Atomic Blonde, which is where the Anthony Johnson connection is with that movie. But
which is an okay movie. It's just not in any way connected.
It's a martial arts movie. Yeah, I didn't mind it too much. Yeah, I know what you mean. No. It's good. So let's just mention. Let's start with what version are you reading from? Because you've got the hardback, haven't you? I think.
Yeah, so I've got the hardback in front of me. So in total, there were eight collects. So there would be eight, nine, 11 hardbacks in total. I'm just trying to think if I've got the entire order. Oh, there's either 8 or 11, depending on which way you count it. Each one being the individual operations. Or the miniseries that came out.
Yeah.
And I presume you've got the big phone books.
Yeah, see, we were talking about this before, weren't we? Because I came to this slightly late. So I think I came to it in about 2007 because I had heard Chris Neesman talking about it on a Round Comics podcast. And he was a huge fan of it. He's a big Rucka fan. And I bought the first... it's like a slightly smaller in height. Like a paperback. It's just slightly larger than the paperback. And it's got, I think, about the first 20-ish, maybe about the first 10 issues in it. I bought that, loved it, and then I had to track down the actual trade paperbacks that had come out before, if you see what I mean. So that's why I went about it. Yeah. Yeah. Did you read it in floppies, did you, Dudor?
So, yes, I read it in floppies. So around 2000... this has all been published by Oni Press.
Yeah.
Oni Press started, I think, 99 or 98, there, thereabouts.
Right, okay.
And I was trying to be pretentious at that point, I guess, being being whatever age I was at the time. And I knew that I'd missed the heyday of Dark Horse. And Oni Press started up and produced quite a few good books up front. And I basically had a standing order with the Planet at the time that said, basically give me everything that Oni Press puts out.
Oh, wow, okay, right.
Trying to basically say, look, if you can follow a company across producing lots of good stuff, then, you know. And I did that for a while. And
yeah.
They're, not everything, but
there's a lot of different kind of stuff they brought out, didn't they? Did they do Mice Templar? I can't remember now. Was that them?
No, that was something begin with A.
It was Archaea, wasn't it? Pardon me. Yeah, it was.
I think it was.
They did
Clarks.
That's what I'm thinking of, yeah. Yeah,
the Dogma book.
Yeah.
They did. The only double feature was the first thing, which had loads of stuff in it.
Oh, Marfood's in that, isn't he? I think.
Yeah, Marfood's in that. Yeah. Barry Ween is an amazing book, and there's a bunch of early Bendis actually that came out through them
of course
as well. Now, this is all before the, it was all that. So anyway, I picked up Queen and Country at that point in time.
Yeah.
There was also, this is maybe one of the tiny down things, one of the down things for this. I do think in terms of the floppies when it first came out, there was a proper bait and switch because the first four issues featured covers by Tim Sale.
Yep, as the trades do that I've got, yeah.
And you know, and even in the hardcover, they're done as the sort of the breaks throughout the book.
Yeah,
they are lovely color covers. The Steve Rolson art is really, really good at getting the story across and really good at telling the story. But it's quite jarring how different it is.
It is very different,
from,
isn't it?
From the Tim Sale.
Yeah.
So I think there will be a lot of people who have picked up going, "Oh, Tim Sale's, you know, I love the sort of stuff on there," and then there's a cartoonishness to Steve Rawlinson's work. There's a cartoonishness to his work, but it's still very clean and it's very tight. And one of the things that he's really good at is making the same character, or you know who which character's which throughout.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that, you know, none of them are wearing any sort of superhero costumes or anything, so you know you don't rely on the guy in the big bright red cape. Yeah. I know who he is, regardless of what his face looks like. This needs to be, there's three guys sitting in a room with suits, but I know who each one of them is.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he's really, really good at that. Yeah. But I do think there was bait and switch in terms of
I agree totally, man. And I like the Tim Sale stuff. And I think Tim Sale, I think I read, when was Halloween? That was it 96, 97, something like that? So the trade paperbacks were coming out around that. He was the hotness at the time. Knowing what Only Press were like, they probably couldn't afford him for a whole issue and didn't have the time to put aside, so they've got Rolston on. And I do like his stuff, and you're right. It's very sort of, I don't know how to put this, it's very unshaded. It's very clean line, white and black.
Yep.
You know, there's no mucking about. It tells a story, and you're right. He's an interesting guy because he hasn't done much comic stuff. He did The Escapist with Brian K. Vaughan. He did Public Relations out of Devil's Due, which I haven't read, and I think he's gone off to do like cartoon storyboarding, as I understand it now.
Yeah, you call Hollywood, that's where you get your money.
Yeah, that's it, man. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. In terms of his art, though, one of the other things, if people haven't seen this but have, you know, seen other bits, I would actually liken it in some ways to a Cerebus feel.
Okay, right.
And what I mean by that is that, you know, the characters are, you know, quite exaggerated, but, you know, very, very precise as to which each of the characters is, but with a cartoony feel to it.
Yeah.
But the backgrounds,
good point, yeah,
are hyper detailed.
Yeah.
Where they need to be. You know, there's lots of offices and stuff. I'm just actually even turning to page one where this is the ops room.
Yeah.
Where you've got, you know, maps up on the wall and computers all over the place and people sitting at desks with telephones and all that sort of stuff. There's an awful lot of detail in there.
Yeah.
But as soon as you turn to page two and it's the faces of the people talking, that's where it takes on that little cartoonish style. Which cartoonish sounds like it's doing it down. Part of this was some of the reviewers have talked about it again. Oh, it's far too cartoonish. It doesn't fit the telling of the story. I completely disagree with that.
No, it threw me straight. I found it jarring when he left. Actually, when it swaps it out for, I can't remember who takes over the next one, I didn't like it as much because my eye was in with him. You know, at that point, when Leandro Fernandez, it might be Brian Hurt. Yeah,
no, Brian Hurt's second, and
that's quite in keeping. I didn't mind that.
Yeah.
I think it's when Leandro Fernandez took over, who's the guy people will know from. What's the recent movie that's come out?
Old Guard.
Old Guard. He did Old Guard, didn't he? Yeah. I found that slightly more jarring. And I think because it's a nice, clean... I had it in this sort of digest-sized book, which I recommend getting. I think you can still find them. And it's a nice, quick, clean read, isn't it? It's a fast-paced book, and it doesn't take you long. And that first trade, when you recommended it to me, that we should read it, I went and reread it. And it's a nice, quick, you know, read to
I'm going to be honest with this because you and I have taken on bigger books in the past.
It wasn't the 500 pages we did in our first attempt. We said
let's do this, and we said let's just stick to book one.
Yeah.
And so I powered through that, and actually powered my way through book two and three as well. Not least of which because I knew that then matched the phone book. The phone books, depending on where the conversation went.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. There are different art styles that flow through, but. it is nice that, you know, you open up this book and the before you actually get into the comic, there's the roster page.
Yes, yeah.
Which you've got all the heads of who's...
Yeah, that was really useful, man. I really like that. And I made a note of some of that stuff because you don't remember everyone and it's nice to have the names. I'll tell you what, when you're reviewing a book as well, how often do you read a comic and remember everyone's name? You don't do it, do you? Do you know what I mean? No. So it's quite useful for us today. Yeah, definitely. And it's really nice, and it's done on sort of... maths paper, isn't it? It looks like it's done on the sort of set of maths paper, which I really like, and there's sort of coffee smudges and stuff on it. And we'll get onto this in a minute, because it's kind of set in the real world. I will be taking an issue shortly that I don't think Mr. Rolston has ever been to London, but the which we'll talk about in a bit. But it is kind of set in the real world, which we're going to talk about in just a second. But I thought we'd mention some of the other artists who've worked on it. So we've, like you said, we've got Leandro Fernandez and Brian Hurt. Brian Lee O'Malley inks him on that, doesn't he? I think.
Yep.
Yeah. That was an intro. I've completely forgotten that and it surprised me again that is what happened a long time before a lot of other stuff he's done. Jason Sean Alexander, who's still very busy. Carla Speed McNeil did Stormfront. Mike Hawthorne. And then in issue 25, we get Mike Norton. He does one. Love Mike Norton's work.
Yep.
And then he's back for a story again. And then we get Chris Samony in Red Panda.
Yeah.
Look at that. Yeah, how good is that? Yeah, there's been some real class on it, and some real class at people who've not been new, but on their way up, I'm going to put it. I suppose Mike Norton was kind of on his way up back then, wasn't he? You know.
Yeah, but I think a lot of these guys as well, it was about... Greg Rucka was still quite new.
Yeah, he was,
To comics. Yeah. Obviously, he had his background as an author and had produced a number of well-loved novels at that point. You know, but he was still relatively new to comics, and I think there's a pairing there that goes along throughout this about Greg Rucka has really always been good at being paired with good artists,
yeah,
or artists that work for him, sort of work with him in terms of his style.
Right.
Because I think if you look at some of his other work, whether it's with DC or else, you know, there's I'm specifically thinking of Michael Lark there in terms of the Gotham Central stuff.
Yeah.
The pairings have always, I think, worked really well. Greg Rucka is probably slightly underrated as a writer.
I think so, man, as well.
In terms of his recognition.
He's also like an incredibly nice guy. I met him, he signed one of my Queen and Country trades at London Film and Comic Con, and there was no one there chatting to him because it was they were all looking for stormtroopers as usual. And
clearly, I just left his table at that point because I was
You were that one. All right. Did he go to his talk as well? He did a little talk after that.
Yeah, we're both
at that, man. Oh, there you go. And I had a long talk with him about it, about the character, you know, and really interesting about it. And he's one of these guys who loves talking about story. For anyone looking for a good interview, he just did a word balloon with Denny O'Neill, where he talks about Denny O'Neill and his sort of respect for him. And you can see a straight line between the two there. And I think he would be pleased about that. And I think it definitely shows. And Suntris and him talk very sensitively about it. He's a thoughtful guy. And I really liked him. He does a sort of series of interviews, doesn't he, on Word Balloon? Used to have him on quite a lot to do long form interviews. And they're really good. Yeah, I'd love to sit down and have a chat with him. Because he writes this sort of thing very well. You can tell his heart is in Private Eyes, Spies, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because no, I've also got a copy of the script book, Volume 1.
Yes, I got that as well, actually. Yeah.
So that's what he signed for me, and he's written inside it, "Now you know all my secrets."
Oh, right, so he wrote inside one of mine, "Do you think she's pregnant?" I think it's what he wrote, something like that.
Yeah.
Or "She's pregnant, you knew." I think it said something like that in there. Yeah, super nice guy. Yeah, really good. Yeah, now, he is quite open about this being inspired by something, and we also agreed that we talk about this. So, did you want to just mention what is inspired? I mean, he's quite open about it, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. There's bits of it I would argue having. Right. So he was inspired by a Yorkshire television series.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, what on earth are you coming from? That came out from 1978 to 1980.
Yeah.
Again, you're like, on how on earth? Called The Sandbaggers.
Yes. Which doesn't sound anything like a spy series, does it? You know?
No.
Yeah, it sounds like it's the Seaside film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the Sandbaggers are the highly trained individual operatives who basically, if there's a flood, go in and sandbag.
Yeah.
Or go in and do what needs doing. And
clear up messes as well, I think, is part of it, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. So, as I say, 1978 and 1980, it stars some, you know, Roy Marsden's in it as the principal character.
He's great, so good. So like
it's
yeah. You can work out where it is in an episode by how stressed he looks sometimes. Yeah, it's like one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there are only 17 episodes in total.
Yeah.
I will tell you now that you can get them on 3D DVDs if you like, or if you're working at home at the moment and are therefore have access to YouTube while on your work computer, you can get them all and go through YouTube and get them all that way.
Oh, I didn't know that. They were on YouTube. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
The
some odd edits, but they're fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a problem now. There's the guy creator is a guy called Ian McIntosh, MBE, aka Hamish. Yep. Ian McIntosh. He was a Scottish guy, but he was also a naval officer. He created a TV series for the very old people who are listening to this called Warship, which I think was another. It was ATV or ITV or one of those sort of regional series again. Yeah. And on the 7th of July 1979, he was in a light aircraft going over Alaska with two other people. He sent out a distress signal and crashed, and no wreckage has ever been found. Now, that's the big conspiracy, is it, that everyone mentions around the sandbaggers, is he was a naval officer. I don't know whether he was in naval intelligence or anything like that, but he was writing about MI6 and overseas. Some of it is overseas, some of it's in the UK, isn't it? And there's a big conspiracy theory going around that he was offed, basically, isn't there?
Yeah. See, having watched that again very recently, it hasn't dated because it sets itself very much in the time.
Right.
And actually, it demonstrates why spy thrillers are actually much more interesting when they're set late 70s, because there's no mobile phone.
There's no internet. Yeah.
You know, there's no satellite phone or anything. Yeah. So it is it's brilliant. Like, you know, get me on the next flight to Bangkok, and the guy, you know, gets out the book and starts looking through the book to find BA flights. or you know, it's like, how long before they check back in? Well, it depends how long it takes them to find a phone in the...
Yes, you know, yeah, he always checks back
two
in.
Two pence into it.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, if the head of MI6 was going to speak to the head of the CIA at the American embassy, he'd probably do it on some, like, special video phone now, wouldn't he? But he just goes and sits on a park bench next to her in this, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
That's what I like about it. And it's as much an action-adventure sandbag as... In fact, it's probably more a political, personal thing, isn't it? It's about the machinations and the Machiavellianations, or whatever you call it, of the two different governments, and how America and England play off each other. We're not always as helpful as we think we are, you know?
Yeah. Well, the whole premise of both the sandbaggers, and Rocco said that he takes this very much into Kunin country,
right,
is that every time the sandbaggers face a problem, they've always got two enemies that they're facing into.
Okay.
You've got whoever the bomber is, or whoever the, you know, well, in Sandberger's case, it's always, you know, what's happening behind the Iron Curtain, or who's trying to go from one side to the other, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But the other enemy that you've always got is the government, where making decisions, not necessarily about for the good of the country as a whole, but more about their political game.
Yeah.
So it's like, yes, we want that person to be assassinated, but not on that date.
Yeah.
You know, things like that, where it's those silly stuff where you're like going, yeah, there's, you know, so there ends up being, so there's actually three layers to it, because you've got politics with a big P, politics with a small P,
yeah,
because there's a lot of the internal office politics.
Yes, there is, isn't there? Which he plays again on this, because we've got the three minders, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but you've also got the intelligence team versus the operations team.
Okay.
Who's more important? Yeah. And you've got the MI5 versus the MI6.
Yes,
as well,
that plays a big part in this one, doesn't it? Yeah.
You know, who has ownership of this particular thing? Which, to be honest, like, you, in the same way that anybody that works in an office environment will be fully aware of going, yeah, it doesn't matter that if you're not going out killing people, it's just that you're trying to sell widgets. You've still got, is it the marketing team or the products team that's in charge?
Yeah, you've stolen my job. It's like that, isn't it? Yeah.
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 And then alongside all that, you've got a recognition that the British Special Services are not going to be the most well-funded, not going to have everything that's in place. So therefore, you have to have a relationship with the CIA and other worldwide agencies to say, well, hang on, leverage, you know, the powers and the information and the, you know, the tools that you have so that we can actually get the job that we want done. And that ends up just being a lot of favors being traded backwards and forwards about different things all the time.
That's the big point of it. It's like adult politics, man. It's like adult espionage, isn't it, to me? I think he uses the phrase as if Bond was real, and I kind of like that, you know.
Well, again, I'm taking this from the Sandbaggers rather than from the Queen Country, where D-Ops turns around and basically is chastising the head of one of the other intelligence agencies. He goes, "If you want James Bond, go to the library. For successful operations, sit at a desk and think. Then think again. Our battles are fought in the dreary corridors in Westminster."
Yeah.
And I thought, that sounds, you know, and it is that, you know, it's all about the thinking rather than the doing.
It's very involving. You get really caught up in each episode, don't you, about what's going to happen. And you can really see Rucker drawing on that because not everything plays out the way you expect it to play out. And there's that sort of thing to it, isn't there?
It's quite funny because we would normally say for a program that's coming up on 40 years old, you know, there are no spoilers. But if you've not seen Sandbaggers, dear listener, go watch Sandbaggers. And I'm not going to spoil the end of season one for you, but it is one of the biggest twists that you'll ever see on television.
And I think people forget this series because of Le Carre, don't they? I think people think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Smiley's People, that's what happened in the 70s and 80s, which are good, but don't get me wrong, but this is worthy as well, I think. Yeah.
I think, I mean, this does lack some of the
money put into
finesse.
It.
Well, actually, you know, because it's filmed on the same sort of sets and the same cameras and everything as Coronation Street was for the 1970s. Yeah. And everybody looks just like that is the way that it is. It doesn't look that razzmatazz when people watch it, but it's it. And I've written this down in terms of the Queen Country books. Queen Country books have, you know, there's a lot happening in them, but you're never in it for the action and the explosions and all that stuff. Queen Country is a sipping comic.
Right, okay.
You sip at it and go, I'm thoroughly enjoying this, and I'm not going to rush my way through it, and I'm not going to be, you know, blown away every time. You know, I'm just going to sit back and sip it. Because you are doing that whole thing about going, if this is going to work properly, you know, if these people are doing what they need to do, they're going to work properly, and it's going to be think it through, and then something will happen. As you'd expect, or it's like being a firefighter in some ways, where television programs about firefighters are always, oh my God, there's action, oh, there's do this, do that, the other. When in reality, it's, you know, if you're a firefighter, you spend
playing table tennis,
huge amount of your
time table tennis all the time,
being utterly bored.
John Lates told me he's really good at table tennis. He's told me that.
And then when it happens, it properly happens, and you have to be on the ball and on the, you know, and deliver hard.
Yeah.
But it is a case of no, you can't, because you can't run at that speed all the time.
Yeah.
So, but it is that going, actually, our purpose of being here is to be ready, which means sitting down. And from the spy's perspective, that's sit down and read who is who and be up to date with regard to local interaction. So if I'm dropped into the middle of Marrakesh, I know where things are and who I'm speaking to.
Yeah, stations and that sort of thing. Yeah. The one thing that didn't date well is who's the main character in Sandbaggers? Is his name Burnside? I can never remember. Burnside lives in Dolphin Square. Now, that didn't age very well, did it? That's that's the scene of a number of spanking incidents in the 80s and a little bit more. But, yeah, it's worth it. So go and look that out. It's if you're expecting it to be John Steed, it's not. If you're expecting it to be number six, it's not. If you're expecting me Tinker Tailor, you might be a bit closer. But it's very involving. And it suffers. It's ITV and it's very well written. I think it's the way I like it. You know, it shows you what writing can be. Cool.
100%.
Nice one. Should we make some comparisons from the storyline of the comic now, just compared to it? Because the general story, I'll lay it out a little bit of what happens in Broken Ground. So Tara Chase is our heroine, hero. She's off doing something from the commencement of the first issue. Turns out she is in, where is she go to? I can't remember where she goes to. She goes to, oh, Kosovo, doesn't she? And she, Kosovo, she kills a general in Kosovo. Now, my history's a bit out of date because I know the general is from Odessa, so I don't know if he's a Ukrainian or a Russian general. I'm not actually that sure, but let's just say Russian, I suppose, at the time, was it? I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, he's supported by the Russian mafia, so regardless of where he's originally from, it's a case of he's in that pocket.
So she's... And one of the other minders actually said, oh, you know, you could have sent me, but I'd have missed. So she's clearly a good marksman. She's up on a roof. She shoots him, kills him. She tries to get away, but gets sort of winged in the leg and just manages to make it back to the UK. Paul Crocker is her direct boss, who's kind of the second hero of this book, really, to me. You kind of see as much of him as you do of her, I think, through a lot of the run of it. Do you think?
So he's head of the operations team, and he sees the three minders that sit underneath him are basically, they're his children in that way, and therefore he has to do everything he can to protect them, but realises that from time to time, you know, they need discipline as well, which means about sending them out to do the nasty things they need doing.
And in keeping with the sandbaggers, he's the guy who's, the shit ends with him. So there's one, so go slightly onwards. She makes it back to UK. The head of the MI5 turns up, and who's his opposite number at MI5. He's kind of, they kind of don't get on. There's competition and animosity between the two, between SIS and MI5. And he says, look, she's got money on her head. She's going to get killed. So we know at that point that they're searching her out to hunt her down and kill her. But the bit that so reminded me of the sandbaggers is when they're told, no, you can't have any guns. The minders have said, no, you can't have guns. You're in the UK. You have guns when you're overseas. And he said, well, they're looking to kill us, you know. He said, well, you can't have guns. So he actually goes to the American CIA woman and asks her for some guns. And I thought, that's so sandbaggers. That just reminded me so much of it, you know.
Yep.
It's like calling in favours. They're forever giving favours, aren't they, is how it works.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you give us this information and we'll give you that. Or you release this person to come work on this operation with us and then we'll give you that. You know, it's entirely that backwards and forwards.
So she goes back to her house, which I didn't realise, but I read in the script book she lives in South Kensington. Now, she's clearly very rich if she lives in that house in South Kensington. I'm going to be honest with you, for a government person. I'm gonna ask Stephen if he's ever over. I'll drive him round South Kensington, and he can pick the house that she lives in because it's going to be about 4 million. I think a garage in South Kensington is 1 million. Do you know what I mean? So she goes back. She gets somebody turns up and says that they're out to get you, and they plan a sort of sting that where they don't have guns, but they manage to sort of use the geography of the streets to catch them out, and you know, and they've actually got, is it like pellet guns or something? I think.
Yeah, so they acquire toy guns so it makes it look like they're carrying weapons to help put them in a stronger position.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it ends up as a fist fight because they manage to get close quarters.
Yeah, it's quite well done. Although the bit that it happens in does look like the back streets of Berlin as opposed to the streets of London to me somehow. Yeah, yeah. That's kind of the in a nutshell, really, the first one. So there's not a huge amount to it. The intrigue does...
Well, there's a big twist at the end as well, because obviously they capture these people that they've had the fist fight with.
Yeah. Of course there is. Yeah.
They then say, right, well, we need to interrogate them. And it's like, well, no, they've been taken off to the farm to be interrogated, which is the pseudonym name that's used for wherever interrogations take place. And essentially, the Americans call in their favor and they want them, so they get them. But there's, you know, again, the internal office politics is backwards and forwards as to, well, before they go, they need to do this, need to that. But it ends up being the MI5, or actually it's taken up the chain, and a political decision is made to give them back to the Americans without necessarily allowing the minders to get the information out of them that they needed. And it ends basically with Tara Chan saying, well, to, you know, one of her superiors, well, let's just hope that I'm not the one that has to shoot you, because I would have hit. And you know, it's the fact that he's just, you know, she's almost killed.
Gives him a jacket, doesn't she? Yeah.
Yeah. There's got a bullet hole in it.
Yeah. There's a bittersweet feeling to a lot of the conclusions or semi-conclusions to this comic, aren't there? It's never completely hero in today, is it? You know, there's something bad that falls out of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. Yeah, that's really good. I have to say, I really like Tara. She is a likable character. And one of the... So, to recap slightly earlier in the story, when she's escaping Kosovo, she's in a car and she gets pulled at the border and she has to show her identity. And there's obviously clearly something wrong with her identification papers. So she's stuck in there, a naked picture of herself. So when she hands over her driving license or passport, whatever it's meant to be, a naked picture of herself falls out because she's got like a young guard. And he's sort of quite smitten, keeps the photograph, and she drives on. And it's the old equivalent of, you know, when we were all 18, we used to keep a tenner in our driving license, didn't we, in case the cops, you know, would let us off the drink drive. Yeah. It's a bit like that, yeah.
I don't know. I never did that. I couldn't possibly comment on the recording. That scene, though, with the having the naked picture, that is a direct lift from a Sandbaggers episode.
Oh, is it? I couldn't remember that. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Where it's one of the male characters hands over a bunch of photos and goes, "Oh no, those are my wife." No,
right. Okay.
Because he's acting as a salesperson going through somewhere behind the Iron Curtain. So when I got to reading the book, having watched the Sandbaggers episode, I was kind of like, "Oh yeah, that's super."
Yeah.
It's not so much inspiration as a lift at that point. Yeah. But you're like, "Look, it's a valid idea, so it's a valid idea."
Yeah. Okay.
And it runs with it. I think there's some things here about Korean country we do need to put in context, okay, however, yeah. Because you talked about saying, oh, is it Kosovo and what was the thing there? This particular book that we've looked at here is a 2001 book.
Yeah.
Right?
The geography of Europe was very different back then as well. You know what I mean?
Well, not like that. It's pre-9/11.
Yeah, oh, right? True.
Which I think makes a huge difference. And because what you can see as you go into... Because the book that follows on from this, the Brian Hart book, which is Operation Morningstar, is still a sort of follow-up on this. It's still very sort of European-based. It's still... it's not. They go into the Middle East at that point.
Yeah.
But the book after that, which clearly in terms of the actual production line piece, where they suddenly are very post-9/11. And there is a shift of going, you know, where's the focus of the intelligence service in terms of, you know... Because pre-9/11, yes, and from a UK perspective, I do imagine it was very, you know, much still that sort of Baltic region element and I think
east-facing. Some of that is reflected in one of the declassified, because one of the declassified, you know, historically, Britain's counter-espionage and terrorism has been Ireland and the and Soviet. You know, and I think one of the declassified is a Northern Ireland one, isn't it? I think that is. And I think that with the... Although we knew about the Islamic threat at that point, it wasn't taken quite as seriously until as post 9/11, and then the whole landscape changed, didn't it?
Yeah. So you can tell a bit. There's a shift in the books as they go through it in terms of where some of the focus is in terms of who the external baddie is for some one of that. But I think that just follows the natural what was happening in the real world, because, you know, Rucker did try to keep this quite real world based, and one of the reasons he ended up stopping when he did was the fact that he just couldn't keep coming up with more, or couldn't keep up with world events in some ways, and he actually wanted it to have some time in place before coming back.
We've just had the Russia report come out, haven't we, about the influence on Brexit and Russia, and you couldn't write that, could you, really? You know. And you've got the security services coming forward and saying, look, we should have, we've concentrated 90% on Islamic fundamentalism and only 10% on, you know, Russian espionage. And, you know, that should have been much bigger. And you can imagine him in the middle of writing a Queen of Country script going, oh, Christ, why did that just happen? You know, it's like that. And I've got to change it all. Yeah. The real world moves so much quicker now. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention in terms of positioning the Queen of Country books... For the 2001 perspective, we've mentioned Bond already. In 2001, Pierce Brosnan was still Bond.
Right, yeah, I get you.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's still very
campy.
Dinner jacket, bow tie, and, you know, go as heavy as you like in terms of the craziness of gadgets. While I would argue that, you know, I think some of the Bond stuff's still crazy, but Queen and Country is much more akin to the Daniel Craig Bond-esque of being that grim and gritty piece. But this is why, you know, it really stood out at the time in terms of being a book that, you're right, was very intelligent and very settled in the real world. And actually, you could, there's nothing that happens in Queen and Country that you don't go, well, that could never happen.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, there's bits you go, oh yeah, she's still running around with a bullet in her leg. And,
yeah.
You know, but it, you know, you're going, you're not really seeing how the big the wooden is. But there's no utter craziness, and there's no, oh, I've pulled out an invisible car, or I've got a watch that can blow up a submarine. You know, so it's very grounded in that sort of reality, very grounded in terms of that sort of...
And we also saw the rise of, what's that character that Matt Damon plays? The Bourne thing, the no gate, but the, you know, just the false ID, the very pragmatic, quick to violence, practical, clever, intelligent spy. You know, it's not like you say, it's not like, you know, if someone attacked Pierce Brosnan, he'd probably do his tie up first, you know, but Bourne would just walk in and punch you. You know, there's that sort of thing. And she's like that. She goes from being, and we'll talk about this in a minute, she goes from being very depressed to being like just a person of action because it's necessary at that point, which you see a lot in this. I think the PTSD thing needs mentioning. I think she is a character who clearly, and it gets worse, I think, as we go through, doesn't it? Various, let's not ruin everything for the reader, but it does affect her. Her life is really an affecting issue with her. And the PTSD thing is something that perhaps wasn't as... funny enough, I read a report on PTSD today for soldiers coming back from war and living on the streets and stuff. And it's a thing that affects her, and it's very impactful emotionally on the reader, I think, the way she is. The things in her, you know, she finds a partner, and that doesn't end well, does it, further on down the line and things like that. She's Rucker really explores what she's like and how she acts, and, you know, very well, I think. What do you think?
I think it's one of these ones where it's like, look, you're doing a job here that is not particularly pleasant, you know. That mix of downtime to panic, is really harsh. And when you're on it, you're properly on it. And yes, the means by which you have to deal with that, I think there's some interesting stuff there again with the, you know, in terms of her boss. So the Crockers all the time, he's just like, well, suck it up and get on with it. I've only got three people that work for me. I can't afford you to go and be the boss. You know, just. Have another glass of whiskey.
There's no psychological support there, is there? Even though they're killing people pretty regularly, you know, they don't have to. You know, I know what you mean. Definitely.
But again, that's that politics bit, if you like, where the, you know, a lot of the time they're arguing, we need more money, we need more funding, we need this, and you turn around and go, no, you can't. You say, well, in which case, I've only got three people,
and that is
which means I'm going to work them.
That
to
really
the
plays on you, doesn't it? They've only got three people to defend Britain, almost, isn't it? It's like all these threats keep coming in, and there's three of them, and they're not all always about. I think, you know, it's like that. Let's. We're getting on for 45 minutes, so let's talk about a couple. I've got a couple of problems with it. Firstly, I've already said that London doesn't work. Completely, it does at moments. Now, he repeats. I'm not sure whether this is pre or post. When I think this was written after, but when was it? A member of the real IRA fired a missile at the MI6 building. He fired it from what is called, if anyone who's been there will know that this is not anything to do with it, but it's called the Pleasure Gardens in Vauxhall. Which so you've got MI6, the famous the building made famous by James Bond at Vauxhall. You then got the railway line that leads into Waterloo from Vauxhall Station, and behind that is what is called the Pleasure Gardens. And he fired it from there. He fired it at MI6, and it bounced off the windows. Right, that's what happened. Now in this, and you've mentioned you've read it in the script books. I'll ask you in a second, but in this, someone is sort of stands on an elevated platform and fires it at, and it goes through the window and kills three people, doesn't it? One of whom is the cleaner, which was a nice little touch because that's the one that they said let's not forget about. I've looked at that, and the only way, bear in mind, I used to work about 10 yards from there. I've worked out you'd have to be standing on the railway line to do that. But did you say he made that up, or he's coughed to making it up? Is it or?
Yeah, basically, he coughs a little bit to saying, well, look, you know, you have to have certain license with regard to geography and storytelling in terms of putting some of that together. Yeah. And yeah, he makes reference in the script book to the IRA attack as well, and saying there's similarities there. But again, it is, you just need to, you know, as somebody who lived through Edinburgh and train spotting and going, you can't run down Princess Street and get
I remember Lockstock when they jumped down some stairs and suddenly they're in the Borough Market. Yeah, I know it from Oxford Street. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we've all been there, my friend. I know what you mean.
So I just took that as, well, look, it's not unbelievable to say that there could be some sort of bombing attack on a building. How do you present that in terms of the visual storytelling? And unless you're specifically, I'm going to be honest, I don't know London well enough to tell you whether it's right or wrong. So, but I didn't expect it to be right. It's possibly my interpretation of that. But I'm willing to accept it.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. It's because it was so personal to me from where he fired it. I was sort of, incidentally, the Pleasure Gardens used to have a pub, if anyone's ever been there, called the Queen Anne, which was quite an interesting pub, I will say. I used to spend quite a lot of time in there with colleagues after having had a drink. And it's now a tea house. It's now a theatre and tea house, which is a huge disappointment. It's all been cleaned up, that area. It used to be like a fight every weekend, but yeah, such a shame. But there you go. So that's good. The other thing I've got a slight issue with, the policemen look like firemen. Their helmets are... I don't know what's happening there. I know it's not an easy thing to draw, but they all look like they're wearing fire helmets running around. But we forgive the Americans sometimes, don't we? Good, old man. Is there anything else you want to mention from the story? I've got a couple more questions to ask you, but is there anything that really stuck out from the story?
There's a couple of the images I do actually think are really nice, like when they are walking around the gardens, when he's talking to the CIA.
They go to the park.
It's beautifully done. Beautifully done. The thing that threw me, because I'd completely forgotten about it, is that there is a backup story in the
I sent you a picture from it, didn't I? And I'd forgotten that was there.
So I literally forgot this existed at all. I mean, it's only a six-page story that had originally been in the Oni, I think it was a summer special or something that, which is, a one-shot anthology that Oni put out. But the thing that threw me is the fact that it's drawn by Stan Sakai.
I know. I read it and then didn't realize. I was thinking, is that the Panda Brothers? And then I went, no, it's Sakai, bloody hell. Yeah.
Yeah.
I take it this was colour as well. Mine's in black and white, but you can tell.
Yeah, it's in black and white that I've got as well. But I think it was, I'm sure it was in the colour special, and that's why. But as it was just the fact that I'd forgotten there was a six-page short story at the end of it, and it was the fact it was Sakai just really threw me. Because you're right, I think I could put that in front of some pretty big Sakai fans, and they would not know it was him.
Before I realised, It's funny, we're just not used to him drawing that sort of thing, and it's... it's a weird one. Mm. And it's only, like you say, it's only like 6 or 7 pages or something, isn't it? No, it's good. I mean, if you can still get these trade, they're like collections of, they're really good to get. They're a really nice read. They fit in your rucksack. Don't worry about it getting damaged. I think the hardback you've got is one of those sort of leather covered ones, isn't it? With an indented image.
Yeah, it's full leather. Yeah. But yeah, it's what they produced them. Again, because it's supposed to be, this is the record that, or you're keeping records, but not putting the files on them.
Okay, I get you.
Computer. Yeah. So it's supposed to look one of those red folders that you would have on a big warehouse down in the basement of the the building. And it's red full sort of leather effect with a sort of gold embossed thing on it saying this is Operation Broken Ground, Coon Country, bang bang. And they did them all like that. And I'm one of these sad people that when I do get a new hardback, I will quite often take the slipcase, the dust jacket off just to see what effort.
Yeah, I do that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes I am going, you know what? It would have been better not to have the dust jacket at all. Yeah. And in this case,
I know people who throw the dust jacket away. Vince Bond at 11 o'clock throws them away. He hates them. Yeah. I can't bring myself to do it, but I do like the look of the book underneath. I've got to be honest. It's the old library looking book, isn't it? It's like, we're not without the bright colours on the spine. Yeah. Okay, man, just a couple of extra questions for you then before we finish. So we've got Tara Chase here, sort of hard bitten, tough. Faster fighting, faster firing a gun, pragmatic, beaten down by the world. What makes her different from a lot of his other characters? So what makes him different from Whiteout's Carrie Stetko, Stumptown's Dex Parrios? Other than a job, is he writing the same person? I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Is he writing the same person over and over, do you think? Montoya even?
And Montoya's perhaps slightly less, but I think for the Rucka Oni universe, as we mentioned before, where it is White Out, Queen and Country, and Stumptown. You're probably right. There's a lot of similarities there in that he is basically. But the only similarities he's really going is that, look, there's a strong female character who is working in a scenario or with a background that means that not everything's okay all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, thereafter, it's about saying, well, that gives you loads to play with in terms of actually telling the stories and telling whatever you want to do in terms of the actual topic. You know, take the MacGuffin at that point and run with it.
Okay.
But your basis there of going, it's a strong character. The fact that all three, you know what, would you be asking me the same question if they weren't all women?
I was just trying to think to myself, that, but they're all white women of a, you know, almost the same age. Physically, maybe not the same hair colour and stuff, but physically similar.
Well, they're all involved in military pursuits at some point in their careers. And you know what, you're probably right. There's a lot of similarities there in terms of the three of them.
I don't mind it at all. And I know Greg has a reputation for writing great characters, great female characters, and I kind of like that. And I like the fact that nobody ever goes to him. Well, I hope they don't anyway. Oh, you shouldn't write a female because you're not a female. Because he's proven he's a writer and he can write great characters. And he writes great male characters as well, let's face it. But, I just found the three of them...
It's quite interesting that, because you could move that, your thought process there as well, could actually go all the way into Old Guard.
Yes, it's on my list. Because
that's also another, white female character with a sort of military-esque background. So yeah, they all have commonality. But then again, you know what?
I don't mind.
Back on track. Yes, they are. They are very similar, and all of a piece that would overlap them all. He is a writer that is remarkably good at producing books about female characters. But you then go, I don't actually necessarily note that she was female. Yeah. It's kind of a non-point.
It would never come into my brain that I wouldn't buy it because it was a female. I would look at it and think, good, I like his stuff, I'll get that. You know, that's how it goes with me.
As I say, in the same way that when he wrote Gotham Central, Montoya was clearly a very big character in that, but it was just, actually, she was just another one of the police.
Yeah.
That was in it. Again, he's working Batwoman as well. It was just, she's just another strong... another strong white female with a military background. I think he's great at that, and he's actually great about writing characters who don't actually have superpowers and giving a strong story and a really strong environment for each of them, because I think that's the big thing about White Out, Queen Country, and Stumptown. The environments in which they operate are actually a big part of it, and then actually the immersiveness.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if some of that comes from his background of more being a full prose author, where is you very used to painting a very strong scene of this is where we are, because you need to understand that. The thing that he's really good at when he puts his comics is he lets the pictures set that scene. So he's really good at getting his artists to get the environment and feelings over. So, because sometimes if you go for an author and read some of their work, their comics can be very, very wordy.
Yeah,
because
they can.
That's what they're used to doing. I never find that with Rucka. I always find that Rucka's, just the right balance.
He does great dialogue, man. He really does. It really flows, and it's really full of personality, which I really like about his stuff. Yeah, I wasn't causing trouble there. I was just thinking, I think it deserves... I like to cause trouble. But it's worth a question, I think. And they're three great characters, and I've enjoyed their books independently. Just as I was sort of writing down a summary of stuff he'd done, I went, well, they are quite fairly similar. But then again, that's a strength as well as anything else, I think. Cool. Well, if you had to recommend another book in the series, which one would you recommend people pick up, dude?
In the Queen Country series? The one thing that it is all interconnected.
Right. Yeah.
So it is a story from beginning to end. I would start at Broken Ground and move on to Morningstar.
Okay.
What I wouldn't start with is almost the inverse. I wouldn't start with the Declassified.
Yeah, I read that.
I would
last,
either leave
actually.
That to last.
Yeah, that's how I did it.
You know, or or fit them in between, because they are prequels, so you kind of need to know who the characters are to then kind of understand the settings a little bit in terms of how it comes together.
What's in print at the moment, but they were the most difficult to find when I was digging them out in about 2008, 2009. Right. I think one had to come from eBay. So
I'm fairly sure that they're all
might be. I'll tell you what, the one thing I was going to finish on is that I think it's been picked up. Hasn't Netflix picked it up again?
It's been in production as a potential movie. Jumped about, since it? About 2007.
Various different people have I heard him say, I can't remember the name of the people now, but I heard him give a little list of people, women, female actors who contacted him to say, I want to play this, because they'd all read it, you know. But as I understand it, it's had a formal pickup now for a series.
It wouldn't surprise me, because
well, off the back of Stumptown and Old Guard, he's doing well, isn't he? Which I'm really glad to see. You know, he deserves it. Yeah.
Well, you know, we talk about Rucker not being that well recognised in the community, but you know, you've got White Out, the movie as well out there. You've got, as you say, the Stumptown television series, which I believe has been renewed for a second.
You know what, man? It's good.
Series.
I like it. There's a couple of episodes that I'm like, oh, they do the bodyguard in one of them, in a sort of role reversal, but it's all right, man.
But it's funny, as well.
And she's great. That is it, Kobe Smulders. She's good in it, and it's got that feel. And Rucker's involved with it, I think, isn't he?
And I'm glad they didn't change the brother, which I would have thought they would
really
have done.
Good. I'm really pleased. He's a great character.
You know, so they kept that. And you know, the old guard's done really well. I mean, been helped by anything new that comes on Netflix at the moment. Everyone's with great something new. Thank God for that. But I think he carries enough weight, and I can see. You know, Queen Country is an easy one for them to make as well in some ways, in terms of, or it's an easy sell to Joe Public with the right people there, because you don't, you know, again, no superpowers, no nothing.
I think it's time again. We had Spooks, didn't we, which was very well thought of, and it's just, you know, Saturday evening TV, you know, it's popcorn TV, but it's a good, my missus watched Spooks and absolutely loved it. And I think it's time, I think we like that sort of thing in the UK, don't we? From The Professionals onwards, you know, The Prisoner even, you know, stuff like that. You know, we like that intrigue.
Yeah. So now I think, in terms of your original question, just work through the trades one after another. Are they on Comixology?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they are. Pass. Yeah.
So,
and I think I've just...
The youth of today can do that.
The reason I mentioned it's TV series, normally we're not bothered, but I think that will be a good reason for the books all to get another relaunch, I think, hopefully. So we'll see them all about in print.
Good-o.
Nice one, man. That was a really good choice. I really like that one. That was good fun. And one I hadn't read for donkey's years since I've worked my way through them. Right, unfortunately, this week we don't have an advert. So Twitter have asked me, they've contacted me, and they've asked me to remove the advert for the week. And the reasoning is there's nothing... as satirical, humorous, or downright embarrassing that could compare to what is currently happening on Twitter at the moment. So go Twitter. So they said, thanks, but no thanks. There you go. So that's, we're moving on. Probably have another sponsor next week. See who we've got next week. Sad to lose Twitter, but as they say, their platform has become beyond satire at the moment. So they pulled the advert.
When parody is dead. Yeah.
Even Spitting Image couldn't do that much of nonsense. Right, okay, good. So a little bit about you. So as we talked about earlier, you've got another Penguin collection on Kickstarter at the moment, going gangbusters. You're about 200% on, you do, something like that, is it?
Exactly 200%. Yeah. I was about to say a watched Kickstarter never moves, and then it did, as somebody up there backing for something. It's fine. So the new book, the... proof of which I actually received today as well. So I need to
Who's
go through
that
and speak to Rich.
Rich at UK.
UK. You just give stuff to Rich and it comes back good. You don't have to worry about
it.
Yes,
I know.
or if you've got any issues, he goes, are you sure? Oh, yeah, right, thanks.
I know what you mean.
He helps me out enough that I will quite happily stick with him. It will come out... back it now and you'll get it for a discounted price, and you'll get all those freebies that come with it as well, because I'll be doing some of the art prints. You've seen what the art prints are like in the past.
Tough, man.
And
it's
nice A5 hard cards that feature some of the art and that goes out in colour and stuff. That's that. Runs through to the end of August if anyone's
looking. Get on that,
just
man.
Search Penned Gwyn and you'll be there.
Could I put the, if you look at the show notes, you'll see there's a link in there. I've pledged and so should you. You're also doing a bit of watercolour at the moment, aren't you? I saw you do a Fozzie Bear earlier, didn't you? I like that, man.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've just been playing around with the watercolours at home and stuff and doing that. So no, I just try to do other different things. No, my big thing today though was having submitted a script off to Sarah Duncan turn.
I think I read about this
earlier.
Yeah.
For her Post for Thought.
Love that. It's great
script
stuff.
That she does. So that was quite nice to, because it's the first time I've properly written something that and just submitted it as a plain script and said, on
good.
You go.
It's easy being a writer, mate. That's what you've got to do. It's easy being a writer. That's what I say to everyone.
Yeah.
I love Sarah's stuff as well. I can see you getting that, man, as well.
Yeah, so no, it was quite... it's still animals and stuff. So no, that was quite good from that perspective in terms of doing a script and getting it out there for somebody else to work on. So it was a good exercise for us both, because I think she was struggling to get anything written and I was struggling to write for other people.
Oh,
so
nice.
It was a nice
and
time
that
together.
Does it run on Sarah's Instagram, does it? I can't remember where I read it. I think I read it on Facebook, I think, is where I look at it.
She, much like the Penguin, does all three. Right. You can do Insta, Tumblr, or Facebook for Post for Thought.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So you'll read it one place.
Sorry, it's great. She's one of these ones. I always wonder why she hasn't been snapped up by a children's book company or stuff like that. Yeah, she's got a really good.
So as I say, it was when I. Because I had thought, well, maybe I'll try drawing it myself. And I thought, no, there's too many cats and dogs in this. give it to somebody who can properly draw animals and get on with it. But not beyond that, as you say, I'm doing a little bit of Muppet watercolours in response to a challenge that was put out there with regard to what is the best Muppet.
Okay, Mr. Snuffleupagus. I get you. No, Fozzie's pretty good. It's pretty hard for me. What about any more commissions? Now, I know you're a bit of an OA fan. Have you bought anything recently or got anything on the bubble?
There is one thing on the bubble, but I'll wait till that comes in before I share it.
Yeah, good.
Purely because it's who knows when. Yeah.
Arm and a leg.
But everything else. It's just a UK one as well, so it's cool. Fine from that perspective. But let the artist work at their speed and not.
We're doing a shadow again. Good man.
Yes.
Good. Class.
So yeah. Gotta get the shadows in, but beyond that, no, I've been quite quiet on that side of things, and how big my collection is. I've got everybody.
I know. Yeah, I keep seeing things pop up and I think, oh, he's already got that. Yeah, I won't let him know about that one. Yeah, because he'll have something with that.
So no, it's fun and games for that sort of things. But no, so no, it's been a big creative month for me in terms of getting Kickstarter out and all these other things as well, sort of happening at the same sort of time, which has been. Been good. So it's the other thing I've realized, because when I was talking to Sarah about what next, and because she was like saying, any more scripts, do send them on, and I was like, but I need to save the next 300 strips to get myself to 2,000 penguins.
Wow, okay.
In terms of the daily piece, and then I realized, because of the, I know I say I do them daily, but it's closer to 4 or 5 a week in reality. So 300 strips is basically a year from now.
Nice.
I'm counting down now, going, I've got a year to get to 2,000 in terms of PG.
I've got my penguin t-shirt downstairs. I just folded that up today. It's been in the wash. Yeah, good stuff, man. Yeah.
Well, new t-shirts is available from the
Kickstarter,
but you can get Shea Gwyn Varro.
Which is that your bloody icon on? I'm looking at it now. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah, there you go.
Shea Gwyn Varro. Only available through the Kickstarter, not available through anyone. All that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Good, man. Brilliant. Lovely to have you back. We'll do another one again soon, I'm sure. But that's brilliant. Thanks, man. So if you can just let us know where we can find you and stuff like that.
So if you go onto any form of social media and search Penned Gwyn, that's PENNED space GUIN, you will find us. There's loads of links in all of those social media posts to take you directly to the Kickstarter, or just search Penned Gwyn on the Kickstarter
website. Good stuff, man. You can find me at tributepress.bigcartel.com for all your not safe for work needs. And we'll be back next week. It was a bit of a delay this week because I had a bad day on Friday at work, so we delayed it till today. But there's another one coming. Who have we got next? Oh, Tom Stewart. There you go. Look, Tom's back. Good old Tom. But
as part of your continuing.
He does. Scottish, yeah, I don't have English yes. people on here anymore. Yeah, I just get bullied by people like Cannon, Stuart, Robertson, you. Yeah, yeah, but it's good. It's good stuff, man. That's where proper comics fans live. I've decided that none of your nonsense, gosh, comics nonsense. Good-o. All right, Geezer, and I'll speak to you soon. Thanks, man.
Cheers.